In this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Alec Lackman, who is currently finishing his PhD work at North Dakota State University, where he studied ecology in the high Arctic region of Alaska. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast. Our guest today is Alec R. Lackman. Alec is originally from the Detroit Lakes area of Minnesota, but is currently a biologist at North Dakota State University. He completed his bachelor's degree in mathematics from Concordia College in 2013. Very recently, he successfully defended his PhD in aquatic ecology, in which he studied tundra pond ecology in the high Arctic region of Alaska. His project was fairly well-rounded, including focus areas of life history analysis, community ecology, entomology, ichthyology, and shorebird ecology. Alec has one chapter of his dissertation published in the Journal of Limnology, for which he was runner-up for the Best Young Career Talk during an international conference in Italy in 2017. Alec plans to finish up and graduate this summer. He has also been working on a side project studying overlooked fishes in the Midwestern U.S. Since 2016, this project has grown into a collaborative effort with colleagues across the U.S., and preliminary findings are currently undergoing peer review process. Welcome to the podcast, Alec.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when I see someone that has a degree in mathematics, I think of Goodwill Hunting type of math problems. Was that the sort of math you were studying at Concordia College?
Not so much. Really, I excelled at math in high school and college, so initially I didn't really know what I wanted to go into, so I decided to stick with what I was good at. And then by the time I realized what my passion really was academically, I had already completed much of the math degree, so I decided to finish it out. But it was towards the end of my math degree that I really began to realize how much of an interest I had in biology, both recreationally and academically, so I decided to move on from mathematics, but still it plays a major role in the biological sciences. But one of the questions you get asked a lot if you major in math is, can you calculate the tax on a bill, for example? But actually not all people that do that are actually good at mental math. A lot of the problems we actually did were proofs and so on, which they can be pretty challenging.
Was it difficult trying to convince your potential advisor at North Dakota State why they should pick someone with a mathematics degree for an aquatic ecology position?
I wouldn't say it was difficult or too hard, I guess, because I had reached out to several professors at NDSU with similar interests to me, and I thought eventually I'd get an opportunity if I was persistent. And because mathematics plays a pretty strong role in all the sciences, whether it's statistical analysis or formal proofs or whatever you might go into. But it wasn't actually that hard because it wasn't a few months into my first few interviews at NDSU that I met Dr. Malcolm Butler. And he was very open-minded to my background. And he thought that it could actually complement work that was being done in his lab, focusing on the climate change effects in the high Arctic of Alaska, because we work with large data sets, or he was working with large data sets at the time, and it could use someone with a strong math background. But he was concerned that I would need to get some more biology, like general biology background, before I really got into the graduate program. So I took 1 year as a part-time graduate student and part-time undergraduate student, where I took these courses both to fulfill that background knowledge that I didn't really have formally, and also get a feel for graduate school at the same time. But then after a year's time, he ended up having additional funding and was able to take me on as a full-time graduate student.
And like I said, you're at North Dakota State right now, and the mascot for North Dakota State, is it pronounced bison or bison with a Z?
Yeah, here people say bison with a Z, but yeah, depending on where you are in the country, people say it in either way. And I know like the NDSU basketball team and football team have made headlines recently. And usually if they get a game that's on the national air, you'll hear someone say bison instead of bison.
I went to Iowa State and we played North Dakota State 1 year, and they actually beat us. And we got quite a bit of heckling in the local media because the North Dakota State fans were pretty defensive about their Z and bison. So just thought I'd bring that up a little bit.
Yeah, I haven't actually been a part of that, but I've definitely heard stories.
So your dissertation research, as we mentioned, it takes place in the high Arctic of Alaska. So I imagine you weren't really in Fargo that much, at least during the summer months. I guess how much of a process was it gained from Fargo, North Dakota, to the far northern reaches of the U.S.?
Yeah, so it was an interesting travel opportunity. And you're right, we were up in Alaska during the summer season. We weren't there during the long winter, but the travel process was we had funding for flights, so we would be able to fly from Fargo basically to Chicago, then Seattle, and then to Anchorage or Fairbanks, and then up to Barrow, Alaska, which was called at the time because my field seasons were in 2014 through 2016 in the summers or spring and summers. But then I think it was late in 2016 or early 2017 when they officially changed the name from Barrow to Utqiagvik, or the indigenous word for the village. But yeah, it was quite a process. I remember my first time getting or landing in Barrow and then stepping out of the plane in, I think it was June 1st, 2014. And there was a little snow drift by the stairs of the plane. It was really cold still. And the weather is usually like 30 to 45 Fahrenheit during the growing season there. You'll get an occasional day that's in the upper 50s and calm, but typically it's very windy, foggy, and fairly cold. But it's amazing how much biological activity is going on in the growing season.
I guess you just mentioned it was about 30 and maybe get up to 50, and then you would fly back home or back to North Dakota in the winter. I guess how much of a shock was it the first summer that you stayed back down in the mainland and experience temperatures higher than 50 degrees?
Yeah, it was. So each year our field season ended before the summer farther south had ended. So we would leave typically towards the end of July. So we would return back to North Dakota, Minnesota area in late July when it was still a full summer. So it was quite a transition there because you're used to being like bundling up, getting out in the wind and sampling invertebrates on the tundra, and then coming back to a place where it's pretty muggy and warm. But one thing that the two areas had in common, at least in one of the field seasons, 2014, was mosquitoes. So in 2014, the mosquito adults had blown up from a southern village called Atkasuk, and they were pretty thick at Barrow. Even though they can't successfully overwinter at Barrow, they were blown up as adults, and they were quite annoying pests that summer, even though I had a lot of experience with mosquitoes growing up in Minnesota. But actually, the mosquitoes up there were quite lethargic and they're pretty tired, it seemed, and they're actually a lot bigger and slower, and they weren't as bad as the mosquitoes in Minnesota.
probably a little easier to swat away being so lethargic.
Yeah, they were. And also, they just never really would bite you, I guess. And I had grown used to them growing up in the Midwest anyway. But yeah, I remember being surprised that they were that far north.
In your bio, I mentioned that you covered a variety of focus areas. But from what I saw, your main focus was on these coronamids. And this is the Fisheries Podcast, and many of the listeners may know what coronamids are. But could you still enlighten us by describing what coronamids are?
Yeah, so the reason why coronamids were the focus of my dissertation work is because they are the major component of the ecosystem in freshwater habitats worldwide, and they just so happen to be even more dominant up in the Arctic. Basically, these are insects that are in the family Coronamidae, and that's why they're called coronamids. They're the non-biting midgeflies. So a lot of people, when they first see them as adults, they think they're mosquitoes because they look very similar from a glance. But actually, these are the insects you might see swarming by a lakeshore or by the river's bank, and they'll form these clouds of these insects that are going up and down, like usually towards sunset. And those are the males that are swarming to try to attract the females. And then when a female flies into that swarm, one of the males will basically pick her off and they'll go down to the grass or area to reproduce, and that's how they complete their life cycle. But actually the majority of their life cycle is spent aquatically as larvae. So they're insects, and they pupate and they emerge as these adults. But as larvae, they're a huge component to the ecosystem for both fish and birds. So many things eat them. and they're also important for nutrient cycling in ecosystems. They're just so abundant worldwide, both in numbers and in species diversity.
Some of the chapters of your dissertation have some large words or terms in them. I guess we'll start with parthenogenesis. I guess, could you describe what parthenogenesis is and how it relates to your chironomids?
Yeah, so parthenogenesis is asexual reproduction. It's a form of asexual reproduction, I should say, where there isn't fertilization of the egg. So usually this is females produce clones of themselves. And that was the case with this one chironomid that we discovered up in Barrow, Alaska, that showed evidence of this. We never found a single male of this species. And we also reared these individuals from larvae to adults, and we isolated adult females, and then they oviposited or laid their egg mass in an empty cup of water. And then those eggs hatched, and I tracked them longer. They developed just fine. So the evidence is strong that this is a parthenogenetic species in that region. But what's also interesting is this species is known to be a sexually reproducing species in Europe, and also parthenogenetic in Europe. But this is the first documentation of it in the New World, basically. And it's also parthenogenetic.
Question just popped in my head. How big are these one species of chironomids that you're having to look at? And how do you tell the sex of, how do you tell the sex of some of these?
Yeah, so the chironomids are usually, as adults, they're usually maybe 2 to 3 millimeters long. So they're not that big. They're hard to see from a distance. But if you have one land on you or something, you'll definitely notice it. But the way that you can tell the sex of the individual is actually quite easy. So the males tend to have, and this is as adults, the males tend to have really what are called plumose antennae, or fuzzy looking antennae, whereas the females have very small reduced antennae. So these are their sensory organs on their head, which is actually how they're picking up the sound waves and so on. So the males have these really big sensory organs on their head, or these antennae, because they're listening for the individual female that flies into the swarm. So if you've ever been through a swarm of insects of any species, you've probably heard their sound. They make a buzzing sound when they're together. So chironomids are like this too. So the males are actually trying to listen for the different wing vibrations of the female, and they have these plumose antennae which help them do that. But there's other ways to sex them, as larvae and also as pupae, and also from their exoskeletons, which they molt from the pupal stage to the adult. So you can pretty much figure out if it's a male or a female at any point in their life cycle. Except when they're extremely young, it can be very difficult. So when they're like a first instar larva, it can be very difficult to know.
Another one of your chapters talks a little bit about the temperature size rule variation. And I think you kind of mentioned it a little bit ago, talking about how the mosquitoes were a little larger up there in Alaska. I guess, what else could you tell us about the temperature size rule variation?
Yeah, so that's a phenomenon that's pretty well documented in science. So what happens to a lot of the cold-blooded creatures or ectothermic creatures is that they get smaller with increasing temperature. And it's thought, like theoretically, that this happens because development is affected differently than growth. So at lower temperatures, if development is delayed more so than growth is, then the final adult insect, for example, will finish at a larger size. So it suggests that at colder temperatures, things will be bigger. At warmer temperatures, things will be smaller. And this is one of the common trends that researchers are discovering as a result of climate change. There's many different creatures that are getting smaller in general. And we found evidence of this in chironomids up in the Arctic at Barrow in the lab environment. So we reared these larvae in controlled temperature conditions in the lab, ranging from about 5 Celsius to 25 Celsius, or like around 40 Fahrenheit to 70 Fahrenheit. And we found quite a shift in the sizes across several different species. But what was interesting is that it seems that female chironomids are more affected than males are. And this would have implications on fecundity, because it's already known that insects produce fewer and smaller eggs when they're a smaller individual. And if they're affected more by warmer temperatures than males are, it could disrupt food webs or something. It basically lends credence to do more study in that system, because like I said, this was lab evidence from rearing them in the lab, but we haven't documented this in the wild. But that would be something of a future study on chironomids.
The one chapter that you have published so far, that was mentioned earlier describes your findings of an extra larval instar in a species of chironomids. I guess first, what is an instar? And second, why is it important to have an extra one?
That was a discovery that people were very skeptical of at first because it's been accepted as a universal or a rule basically for chironomids that they pass through four larval instars. So what is an instar? Well, it's a stage, like the stage of an insect. So insects go through incremental development. They don't grow continuously in the sense like a fish or a human does. It's more like they go through these increments and they have to shed their exoskeleton or molt, and then their exoskeleton in their new body is temporarily soft and malleable, and then they grow into this larger size, which then the exoskeleton hardens again, and they're at this new stage. So basically, chironomids have been known for about a century now to go through four larval instars. So they hatch out of the egg. There's the first instar. They grow, they eat, and they grow. Eventually, they have to molt because they're getting too big for their own skin, and then they molt to the second instar. They do this again, they molt to the third instar, and then they molt to the fourth instar, and that's the instar that's been most well studied because it's the longest duration. So the fourth larval instar tends to take up the largest portion of the insect's life cycle, and they're also used to track development because a lot of researchers want to know when these insects are emerging because they're these ephemeral pulses of biomass to the terrestrial environment. So there's a lot of research that works with fourth larval instar chironomids, but what we found is that there's this species up in northern Alaska that's in this pretty primitive lineage relative to the other chironomids there that goes through an extra larval instar. It has actually five larval instars, and we figured this out by rearing larvae individually and tracking their incremental growth over time. It was very tedious work because you had to track these individual larvae, which are only a few millimeters long, and then pull out their exoskeletons as they're molting and then save them and then archive them. And what we found is that the molt increment in the last instar is actually much smaller than you would expect based on previous evidence in the field. So that's why we think it's been missed all this time. But it now opens the door to new analyses that might look at other chironomid species because it's interesting because it tries to, it's lending insight into the potential evolution of the chironomid family. And it's just not so that every chironomid species goes through four larval instars. But as for why this species does that, we're really not sure if it's an adaptation or if it's just a primitive trait that's kind of a vestige.
So we also mentioned that you did a little bit of work with both birds and fish. I guess, how does your work with chironomids relate back to these shorebirds and the fish communities up there in Alaska?
Yeah, so most of my work with shorebirds was actually a collaborative effort because we worked with an interdisciplinary team up in Alaska. So there was both a landscape team, an invertebrate team, a shorebird team, and we tried to, so I learned some of what they do, but I also had to read a lot of the literature in order to figure out the ecosystem dynamics. So basically how it relates is these, the Arctic coastal plain, which is a huge region of the Arctic, which is basically an enormous wetland. In Alaska alone, it's like 60,000 square kilometers in area. It's huge. And millions and millions of birds migrate there to nest. There's basically fewer predators that far north, and there's a really high abundance of food. And one of the groups where there's tens of millions of them alone are just the shorebird species. And there's only like 30 to 50 species that migrate there. But it's so it's such a hotspot for avian diversity there that basically 50% of North American shorebird diversity breeds in the high Arctic of Alaska. It's a common place for that people go to do birder tourism or ecotourism to see birds. But basically why the shorebirds are of interest here is because shorebird chicks are precocial. So when they hatch out, they are immediately moving around and trying to find food. And so there isn't parental care in the sense that they're going to bring them back food. The little chicks have to find it, and they actually rely on this terrestrial pulse of chironomids. So there's all these chironomid larvae year-round in the ponds, these tundra ponds, which are very shallow and fishless. And then when this huge biomass emerges, it's about a 2 to 3 week span that these shorebird chicks are basically aligned with in time, so that when the chicks hatch, the chironomids have emerged from the aquatic habitats. But what we're finding with climate change, because we also have data going back to the 1970s from when my advisor, Dr. Mac Butler, did his dissertation work, is that the chronomid phenology or seasonal timing is shifted by about a week to 2 weeks now, just comparing that 40-year span, 45-year span. But we still don't know the full impact that this is having on the migratory shorebird diversity, but it is already known that migratory shorebirds are facing declines worldwide, with about 50% of the species declining.
When you were done up in Alaska, you came back to Fargo, and sometime when you were back in North Dakota, you started a little side project studying some overlooked fish species. You got out of the insect game for a little bit. I guess, what are some of these species of fish that you're looking at, and what about them interested you?
So one of the first species that I was interested in and actually gave me the incentive to try to learn how to age fish were the common carp, or was the common carp, in part because my wife, Evelina, she's from Poland. And in Poland and in a lot of Europe, people, they really enjoy carp fishing, or common carp fishing. This is a species that's native to Eurasia. And it's not actually native to Poland or a lot of the places in Europe, but there's just a different attitude towards the species. And I thought it was interesting that we also have this species in the Midwest, and they're typically thought of as a nuisance species, but I was just interested in them because I would see them and they had such a interesting behavior. They seemed very intelligent, if you can attribute that to a fish. They're just a very interesting organism, and their schooling properties is really interesting to me. So I got into that, and then I took ichthyology with Dr. Mark Clark at NDSU in the fall of 2016. And that's when we started trying to, or that's when I learned how to extract otoliths from fish, which are the ear stones. They literally mean ear stones, otolith. And these are special because they're basically the only structure in fishes that doesn't stop growing, even though it's often considered that fish are indeterminate growers. Well, actually what we're finding is a lot of the species we look at, they reach an asymptotic size and they basically have stopped growing, but the otolith is special. It never stops growing, and it puts down these increments that are useful in age analysis. So that's how I got into that. And after we sort of paved the way trying to age some common carp and some burbot or eel pout was another species we looked at initially. Then we also started looking at some catastomids or the suckers, like white sucker. Also looked at some of the game species as well, like northern pike. But basically, I just got practice extracting otoliths and aging a bunch of fish species. And then another species of interest of mine was the bigmouth buffalo, because I had had experience with them growing up. And I had always thought they were really interesting fish as well, in part because they're a fish species that people tend to not care much about, even though it's a native species to North America. And then when we got into aging that species, that's when we realized we were onto something that was very different than what was previously reported.
Kind of hinted at it there, and you found some pretty astounding results, I guess. How old were some of these fish getting?
Yeah, so the very first bigmouth buffalo that I aged was in its upper 80s, 80 years, like 87 years old. And that was over 60 years older than previously reported for the maximum age for the species. So right then and there, with that first sectioned otolith, I was really skeptical that that could be possible, because it was previously thought that the species lives to like 10 to 20 years old, and then it dies of natural cause. But no, here's a fish that's over 60 years older than that, and it seemed to be doing fine at the time that it was killed. But I do remember looking at that first otolith fin section and seeing about eight fractures in the section, and I thought those were the eight annuli. But then the next day I came back to it and I realized there were all these finer increments in the otolith, and thinking that those can't be annuli, there's no way. But then as we started digging into the literature and reading more and more, and I started aging more fish, is when we realized that indeed these are annuli. But then, so some of the ages are in the upper 80s, 90s, even several fish over 100 years old. But we've also aged fish as young as 2 to 3 years old, all the way across the spectrum now.
You kind of mentioned your hesitation at guessing or estimating such a high age of some of these. I guess, how many different opinions did you get at the looking at these otoliths before you finally settled on, yeah, they're just that old?
So it was really only a few opinions here at NDSU. So Dr. Mark Clark was really influential, because he was right away, he was convinced they were annuli, and he just saw the repetitive banding in the otolith section, and he knew right then and there. I remember him saying, "Those are annuli, those are annuli. There's no way they are not annuli." But I was a little bit more skeptical because I hadn't had experience in the field before, and also the ages were somewhat outlandish. But then when later on, as I began presenting, because we had become really confident in our age estimates, and we had done a lot of work, put a lot of work into it before we really started presenting on it. And then when I first started presenting on it, it was met with a lot of skepticism, even though like I had convinced myself that it was real and we had already gathered all this evidence. It took a while for a lot of people, like in the state agencies and at local meetings and so on, to really accept that. And then, but one of the really, encouraging aspects along the way is after those initial presentations, when I was dealing with that skepticism, I reached out to some of the leading experts in the field, like Dr. Alan Andrews in Hawaii and Dr. Steve Campana in Iceland, who are both like leading experts in the field of aging fish. And they both were basically, they were confused why people were being skeptical with us because the otoliths were so convincing. And then things developed further because basically we, even with all the backing from experts, there were still a few who were claiming that these could be false annuli, basically a false band in the otolith. So I didn't really describe like why otoliths can be aged, but this is more of a fisheries audience. So basically it's like aging a tree, the tree rings, but there are still other stressors in the environment that could cause a slow growth period in the otolith. So a lot of the people were saying that, oh, there could be a false annulus every year, for example, when it comes time to spawn. So that was a legitimate concern, like, because no one had done age validation work in the buffalo fishes prior to our work. So basically it led to efforts to try to validate the ages on this species. So in order to do that, I applied for funding at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the National Ocean Sciences Accelerator Mass Spectrometry Lab in Woods Hole. And I was able to get that funding and went out there and helped the what's called the BOM radiocarbon age validation. So we took micro samples of the otolith, and this is where Dr. Alan Andrews became a crucial component to our team because he has expertise in this area, and he was able to micromill regions of the otolith, and we were able to then send those samples to Massachusetts, where then they were analyzed for their radiocarbon, or basically the radioactive carbon isotope in the calcium carbonate of the otolith. And sure enough, we got the results back and they conclusively validated our age estimates. So yes, the ages are real.
So in your opinion, how might these high age estimates affect how we manage or don't manage these overlooked species?
So it definitely has implications for management because currently, as far as we can tell, the big mouth buffalo, for example, is only, it has limits established in only 3 of 22 states in the U.S. to which it's endemic. So in 19 of 22 states, people can take them in no limit. So there's literally no limit established in any recreational form of fishing for the species. And it's also one of our other findings in a broad swath of the region where we sampled is that there is evidence of periodic recruitment. It seems to be a natural or a potential natural tendency for a fish that can live so long. So they go through boom and bust reproduction cycles, it seems. And this is based on a few populations that we've looked at, but one in particular, it seems, is quite unnatural because 80 to 90% of the fish are over 80 years old. And the other 10 to 20% of the fish in that population, they're like 35 to 45 years old. These are all really old fish, and the vast majority of them are older than most people's grandparents. But at the same time, there's all these new methods of harvesting the fish, or one could argue it's not harvest because a lot of times this species isn't utilized for food. But there's new things like bow fishing, which has become extremely popular. And bigmouth buffalo, even though it's a native fish to North America, it has no limits in most states. And it's one of the prime targets of the sport because it's a big fish. But so there's a lot of implications for management, which stem from basically a lack of accurate life history data that was previously surrounding this fish.
Well, Alec, thank you for filling us all in on your research up in Alaska and back here in the Midwest. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
So my favorite fish, like I had mentioned earlier, was initially the common carp or the bowfin. Both of those had been my favorite fish species for quite a while because I really enjoyed their behavior. I also thought they were somewhat a neglected species, and I was interested in the common carp because they're mainly because of their behavior. But then as I learned more about bigmouth buffalo, they became more of an interest, and they're also one of my favorite fish species. But there's several other fish species which I really like, but I would have to say, or I would narrow it down to those three.
All right. And what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
It's probably looking at that first otolith section from bigmouth buffalo and seeing, at first thinking it was only 8 to 12 years old because there were that many fractures roughly in the otolith, and then coming back to it the next day and realizing that, it could potentially be over 80 years old.
And you're going to be wrapping up your PhD work this summer, I guess. What is your dream job or dream location to work in?
I'd probably enjoy working throughout the North American continent, studying a variety of fish species, both young and old. I really enjoy aging fish and also learning more about their life history through other metrics. I think I'd like to stay in ichthyology, and probably my dream job would be to continue aging fish and also providing evidence of all these neglected species that are native to North America, which basically get a bad rap because they're not historically perceived as a game fish, or people have changed their interest over time. But a lot of these species, they are valuable to the ecosystem, just like the alligator gar in one of the previous episodes on the show. Just because they might be different looking or not easy to catch on hook and line doesn't mean they don't have value to the ecosystem, and also doesn't mean that they should not be studied. So I think I could potentially help fill that study area so that there's more information available for many of these kinds of species, and who knows what we'll find out.
You're pretty curious about some of these rough fish and wanting to learn more about them. So I guess the next question, if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Yeah, if money was not an issue, I'd probably like to study the whole spectrum of fish species native to Minnesota and look at the impacts of fishing pressure on those populations. So there's increasing evidence that basically humans, by wanting to fish usually the biggest fish and keeping the biggest fish, that takes those genes out of the gene pool. And it'd be interesting to actually see if that's really happening in Minnesota, for example. Are we finding evidence in the heaviest fish lakes that there's actually smaller individuals overall? And is there a genetic component to that? And also, what's the age structure of the populations of a variety of fish species, both well-sought-after species like northerns and walleye and bass, but also other species like red horse and buffalo fishes and bowfin and freshwater drum, some of these that aren't as heavily fished. It would be interesting to sort of look at that and see if there's evidence of this fisheries-induced evolution.
All right, and the final question, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think it would be that, first of all, a bigmouth buffalo is not a carp. They're in a different family, and they're a buffalo fish, and also that they're native to North America. And we now know that they're the oldest freshwater teleost, capable of living beyond 110 years old. And I think that's a very special trait which warrants further study.
Alec, thank you again for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your projects up there in Alaska and back here in the Midwest with some of these lesser known or lesser studied species.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
So probably the best way to reach me is via email, and just my first dot last name at ndsu.edu.
If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 34th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, bigmouth buffalo are not carp and are native to North America and are now the oldest freshwater teleosts.